America Inc. versus Andrade, and we hear from Mr. Mitchell.
May it please the court. The state of Texas has enacted a series of laws that protect the residents of our state from negligent or fraudulent conduct occasioned by persons who collect other people's completed voter registration forms with the promise of delivering those forms to the county authorities. The district court issued a preliminary injunction after concluding that five regulations of these volunteer deputy registrars violate either the First Amendment or the National Voter Registration Act. Each of the district court's legal conclusions is wrong, and its preliminary injunction order should be vacated. The speech clause of the First Amendment simply is not implicated by the state's VDR regulations, because Texas regulates only the conduct of collecting another person's completed voter registration form. That is not speech of any sort, and there is no First Amendment right to take another person's completed voter registration form and act as a courier on that person's behalf. We want to make clear that Texas does not in any way limit or regulate the ability of anyone.
Let me ask you this, though, but where do you agree that where conduct is closely intertwined or related to core speech, the state can't regulate that conduct so that it interferes with the core speech?
We agree that if the state were to regulate conduct in a manner that prevents someone from speaking,
even if it interferes or impedes their getting their message out.
Well, there's no interference or impediment imposed
but if
here.
If they did, then that
would certainly present a more difficult case, and it's quite possible First Amendment scrutiny should apply.
How would that differ from a time, place, and manner regulation?
Well, it would depend on the circumstances of the case. Time, place, and manner questions are very fact dependent. It's just not factually accurate for the appellees to assert that the speech components of a voter registration drive are inextricably intertwined, because a non-VDR, a person who does not have the permission from the state to collect the completed voter registration form, is still capable of engaging in every speech component of the voter registration drive. I do not hold a VDR appointment, but I can still go out and urge people to register and distribute blank forms.
But the message of the plaintiff is register to vote. Their mission and their message is get people registered and qualified to vote.
Right.
And I guess you can look at it as you do in two steps. One is persuading the potential voter to sign the application. The rest of it is the other part of it, before he's qualified, is to get that application and, of course, get it in proper form, no errors, and get it to the registrar. Until that happens, they haven't completed their message, have they?
Well, they haven't effectuated a registration of the voter, but there's no First Amendment right to succeed in a voter registration drive. They can still drive the registered voter to the mailbox or drive the voter to the county registrar's office to drop off the form. There are many ways in which they can still ensure that the forms are delivered. But the First Amendment does not give them a right to collect that form and deliver it for the person who's seeking to register.
But doesn't Meyer say that the plaintiff or the speaker has the right to get his message across in the most effective and efficient way that he chooses to do it?
Well, what Meyer says is that the act of petition circulation qualifies as speech because that act, quote, of necessity involves speech activity. The act of collecting a completed voter registration form does not necessarily involve speech.
Well, of course, in the Supreme Court, in Meyer, Colorado made a very similar argument to what you're making today. They said that the petition circulator, who is equivalent to the VDR in our case, is the person with a public duty only to determine the validity of the signatures of the person who signed the petition.
Right.
The verification of signatures does not constitute speech, and the prohibition against payment of petition circulators constitutes nothing more than prohibition against payment for the act of verifying signatures. The fact that a person voluntarily links his conduct with speech component does not transform that conduct into speech.
That's true. But if
and that's,
you,
just, that's, to me, almost the same as your argument.
But there's nothing in the Meyer opinion from the Supreme Court that says.
Well, they didn't even discuss it, which tells me something.
Well, they didn't discuss it because that's not the basis on which they decided the case. They concluded that petition circulation qualifies as speech because they said petition circulation of necessity involves speech activity. That can't be said of collecting a completed voter registration form. But Judge Davis, even if it were possible to construe Meyer as rejecting our argument, and we don't think it's possible because we don't see language in the Supreme Court's opinion rejecting our argument, but even if it were possible to construe Meyer this way, this Court should decline the appellee's invitation to adopt the interpretation of Meyer because that can't be reconciled with the earlier precedents of the Supreme Court holding that conduct does not become protected by the First Amendment whenever it happens to be combined or mingled with speech activity. Precedents such as United States against O'Brien, the Sleeping in the Park case, Virginia against Hicks, Rumsfeld against Fair. All these are cases in which the Supreme Court rejects the notion that conduct becomes speech under the speech clause whenever.
I suggest to you that Meyer is much closer factually to our case than any of those cases.
Perhaps it is, but there's no language in the Meyer opinion rejecting the proposition that we're advancing in our brief, that conduct does not become protected by the First Amendment simply by the fact that it's combined with speech activity. There's another problem with the appellee's argument. Washington against Glucksberg holds that litigants must assert a careful description of the liberty interest that they allege to be protected under the 14th Amendment. They cannot resort to vague abstractions. Our friends in opposition are contending that every component of the voter registration drive qualifies as speech protected by the First Amendment.
These particular components of the state's law are unconstitutional. I don't see how you can have any limits on the non-public registrars. The state could simply ban VDRs, could it not?
Well, we believe the state is not required to allow private citizens to collect completed voter registration forms. That is correct.
If
that is the implication of our argument.
The implication of their argument is that there are no limits that can constitutionally be placed on the speech of registering voters. But if that is the case, the state may permissibly ban any private parties from doing voter registration.
No, that's not our position.
But the state could do that in response to their argument. But if this is unconstitutional, right, the state doesn't have to have authorized private voter registrars at all.
The appellees certainly have not conceded any permissible regulations of VDRs in their briefing.
I'm not trying to trap you. Just asking a question.
We believe that
if
the act of collecting a completed voter registration form qualifies as speech, it's hard to see how any regulation of VDRs would survive because the very notion that you need a license or advance permission from the state to collect a form sounds as though it's a prior restraint. And we know from the Supreme Court precedent that prior restraints are almost per se unconstitutional under the First Amendment. That's correct.
They had VDRs for a long time in Texas, didn't they, without the in-state resident requirement, for example?
The in-state resident requirement is recent. That's correct. That was enacted in 2011. But the county appointment requirement has been in place for at least 20 years, as have many of the other regulations that they're challenging in this case. Now, the appellees repeatedly complain throughout their brief that the VDR regulations in our state are unique to Texas. We think it's important for this court to affirm that state-specific policies are not only expected to occur in a federalist system, but they are a beneficial and desirable outgrowth of federalism because they allow states to serve as laboratories of experimentation and they permit citizens to vote with their feet by moving to jurisdictions with more agreeable laws. It's become common for litigants attacking the laws of Texas in court to invoke the uniqueness of our laws as a reason for federal courts to strike them down. And the district court opinion in this case repeatedly invokes the uniqueness of Texas laws in his effort to justify the preliminary injunction order. That attitude does not respect the federalist structure of our government, and it does not respect the role of state innovation that federalism is designed to foster. As for the statutory limits on compensation that are codified in Section 13.008 of the Election Code, the District Court committed a serious error by failing to defer to the Secretary of State's narrowing construction of the statute. The Secretary is the officer charged with enforcing the state's election integrity laws, and her interpretations must be respected as the authoritative construction of statutory meaning. The only basis on which the federal court could reject the Secretary's interpretation is if it qualifies as a rewriting rather than an interpretation of the relevant statutory language. And no one can plausibly describe the Secretary's construction of 13.008 as a rewriting of the statute. The District Court committed an additional error by failing to afford the state courts an opportunity to construe Section 13.008 before enjoining it. In Arizona against United States, the Supreme Court's immigration ruling from last term, the justices made clear that a preliminary injunction should not issue when a state statute, quote, could be read, end quote, by the state courts to avoid the possible federal constitutional or statutory preemption problems. If I could, in my brief time remaining, I'd like to turn to the district court's preemption holdings, starting with the state's policy that forbids VDRs to photocopy completed voter registration applications in their possession. Here's what the federal statutory provision says, and I'm quoting from 42 U.S.C. section 1973 GG-6I, quote, each state shall maintain for at least 2 years and shall make available for public inspection and, where available, photocopying at a reasonable cost, all records concerning the implementation of programs and activities conducted for the purpose of ensuring the accuracy and currency of official lists of eligible voters, end quote. There are two major problems with the district court's conclusion that this provision extends to completed voter registration applications in the hands of VDRs. The first problem is there is no provision in the National Voter Registration Act that protects the confidential data that appear on completed voter registration forms. If these completed forms truly qualify as records within the meaning of Section 1973 GG-6I, then every person or entity has a federal statutory right to photocopy the Social Security numbers, the dates of birth, the telephone numbers, and the home addresses that appear on these completed forms. Now, Project Vote correctly says that it has no desire to photocopy the Social Security numbers that appear on these forms. But they cannot deny that their interpretation of the statute will give every person in the country a federal statutory right to photocopy that confidential information. The fact that Project Vote does not wish to take advantage of that statutory entitlement does not qualify as an argument in favor of their interpretation of the statute. The district court, in its preliminary injunction order, tried to limit the scope of the photocopying requirement by saying that the confidential information should not be allowed to be photocopied. But he had no basis for doing this because there's no provision of federal law that limits the scope of the obligation in Section 1973 GG-6I. There's a second problem with the district court's construction of the statute. This provision cannot logically be construed to extend to records that are not in the state's possession because the statutory obligation requires the state to, quote, maintain, end quote, these records, as well as to make them available for photocopying. It is not possible for a state to maintain records that are not in its possession. If the VDR holds the completed voter registration application, there is no way for the state to maintain that form. Under the district court's construction of the statute, the state would be violating federal law if a VDR took a completed voter registration form and threw it in the trash can. Under the district court's construction of the statute, a VDR would be obligated to make the completed voter registration forms in its possession available for photocopying to the general public. That strikes us as absurd, and neither the district court nor the appellees have offered any way to avoid that outcome under their interpretation of the statutory language.
While you have time, let me just ask you, is there anything in the motion panel's opinion with which the state disagrees in terms of the rationale? I assume you were pleased with the result, but is there anything that you take issue with in terms of the reasoning or the approach of the motions panel?
No, not at all. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Dunn.
May it please the court. My name is Chad Dunn, and I represent Voting for America and Project Vote, the Appalese in this case, who urge that the injunction issued by the district court be affirmed. I'll start my argument where my friend Mr. Mitchell started his, and that's at the First Amendment analysis. What the state has tried to do in its argument in this case is step aside and ignore Meyer and Buckley, the U.S. Supreme Court cases directly on point, and instead talk more abstract about the general First Amendment test. In fact, we see in the opening brief that the state has filed with the court, they don't even mention the Meyer and Buckley case. And so I think starting with Meyer is the place that one must rationally begin in order to analyze the issues in the
case. But aren't petitions and solicitations to change the law very different from registering voters? Petitions and solicitations are the essence of concerted conduct for the purpose of persuading people in a speech way that they need to change law. Registering voters is inherently an act. Not that they can't have speech advocating it, but at some level you have to the action they could. What do you say to that?
Well, we respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Petition to the state to enact a state law, which I think is a critical point I want to come back to, but in answering your question, a petition to the state is a petition to the government to make this the policy. A voter registration application is a petition to the government to enable and make this person eligible to vote. So in that way, we think they're the same and similar activity.
You can do that. You can do all of that. You can do it with, it's not a question of alternative means. There is no speech advocating voter registration that is in any way prevented here.
Well, the test that the Supreme Court came up with in Meyer and then followed up with in Buckley was, does the restriction reduce the quantity of speakers, and does it prohibit the First Amendment organization from achieving its goal? That's the test.
But those are solely with regard to petitions and not to voter registration drives, aren't they?
No, we would disagree. Again, respectfully, we disagree with the court's conclusion in that regard, because again, we see this as a petition to the government to be eligible to participate as a voter.
Well, let me ask you the question that Mr. Mitchell didn't answer. The state could ban all VDRs, could it not?
No, they could not.
Under what law or principle? I don't say speech. I'm saying it could ban the use of private registrars. It could say that everybody who wants to register to vote has to go to the Driver's License Bureau or the county, the county judge or whatever.
We do not agree with that position. We don't think the government can ban a particular religion, a particular church,
a particular
nonprofit. Well,
you can set qualifications on voting at 18 years old of sound mind.
Certainly.
All right. Why couldn't they say the state can opt not to require any registration requirement. Everybody could walk in on the day of voting, as a couple of states have apparently allowed. But by the same token, the state can also say, if you want to vote, you've got to get a voter license, and you have to get that through the state.
Well, as Her Honor stated earlier, sometimes we have to agree to disagree, and certainly Your Honor's opinion means more than mine in this proceeding, but I can't concede and won't concede today that the state could ban the right of citizens to get together and associate and encourage others to register to vote and assist in that association with others to vote. And
they could do that. They can put them in buses and take them down to the county judge's office.
Well, then that gets back to the Meyer test. Does that restriction actually relate to a particular governmental interest, of which there's no evidence here, of course?
Well, preventing fraud is, I mean, this is only preliminary injunction, and you don't have any evidence that there's no fraud, and the Crawford County case said that we presume that the state has, a reasonable basis to fear fraud in elections. So that could come in at trial, but right here we're just talking about facial constitutionality.
Well, the Crawford...
It's your burden, not theirs.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your last question.
It's your burden, not theirs.
It's our burden, that's true.
Injunction.
But on a factual determination, this court would have to find that the district court was clearly erroneous. There ought to be, and there is in the law, some deference to the district court who heard the evidence. But on the Crawford point, the point that Justice Stevens made in Crawford is that there is a limited burden in Indiana's photo ID law under that case because there was a free government ID and other protections. And because there's a limited burden, then we can just accept the state's oral justification without evidence, although there was actually evidence offered by the state in that case. Here, though, we haven't gotten to the burden. I mean, what the state wants to say is that we can just do what we want. And the state didn't offer to the district court by evidence or really argument of how these restrictions are narrowly tailored to deal with the issues of concern the state had. The reason that's important is because in one of Her Honor's questions to Mr. Mitchell, there was this notion or this complaint that, well, if we ban any of these restrictions, then don't we start down this slippery slope where there's just chaos and there's no regulation in these proceedings? And the Supreme Court dealt with that precise issue in Buckley. And, in fact, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was the dissenter in that case, made that argument that, look, if you can't regulate petition signers and petition gatherers in the way the state had, Colorado had wanted to in that case, then we'd get this parade of horribles. It was directly rejected by the majority opinion of the Supreme Court because it said, we're not saying that you can't come up with regulations. We're just saying you have to narrowly tailor them. Like, for example, there is a requirement under state law of not committing fraud. It's subject to criminal penalty. That stands. The requirement that the applications be turned in with so many days, that stands.
So it's okay it's perfectly within your constitutional rights to tell those people from Acorn, you have to show me 100 registration cards today.
I'm sorry, I'm not following Your Honor's question.
Well, because one of the things you say isn't narrowly tailored is the compensation provision that ties compensation to the number of registrations you get.
Well,
you're saying that's not narrowly tailored.
We're saying, well, that the compensation provision we think falls directly under Meyer. And certainly, if we're going to pivot and talk
Meyer
about
it. Meyer only said you couldn't ban compensation. This does not ban compensation. What this does do is it eliminates the disincentive to have compensation based on a quota.
Well, that's true. And my client hasn't opposed the quota provision of the compensation provision.
So how can you challenge it facially if you don't?
Because there's three sections to the statute, and our concern has to do with subsection 3 that says if you facilitate in any way an application and your performance has something to do with your compensation, in other words, in the number of applications you facilitate and turn in, then you violated the statute with criminal penalties. And the Supreme Court says in U.S. versus Stevens that folks are not expected to undertake First Amendment activity and then have to sit back and wonder if they'll be prosecuted for it. I mean, it's precisely because of the Acorn experience that the court mentions that my clients are sensitive to criminal statutes and wanting to know in advance.
So if your clients pay $10 an hour to people to collect signatures, nothing's going to happen. You have not. I don't think you've even shown a threat of sanction here.
Well, the lawyer for the state in the hearing before the district court when presented with that question said, well, we would take it on a case-by-case basis. And the district court does an excellent job over the course of several pages explaining how a company is to not know, a company like mine and others that do voter registration, how are they to know whether if I bring in a person and say, look, you only did two applications last week, you need to do better, and they come back and they only do one the following week and they're released. Is that covered? I mean, that's clearly facilitating applications under the statute. And so our point is, when you're going to assign a criminal penalty to it, under U.S. versus Stevens, a recent U.S. Supreme Court case, you have to lay down the specific area, and you have to narrowly tailor it. And again, the state doesn't even attempt, by evidence or argument, to claim that any of their regulations are narrowly tailored. Like, for example, on the out-of-state requirement.
Well, Secretary of State said that this only applies if you have numerical quotas.
Well, but, okay, and again, you know, I suppose it's nice, and we've since had a new Secretary of State, so hopefully the new one has that same interpretation, but with 254 county attorneys and district attorneys, that's little solace to an organization that has been subjected to criminal prosecution or has been aligned with folks that have been subjected to criminal prosecution before, which is why they do the responsible thing here. They come to the federal court first, and they say, what are the limits of the regulation? And these statutes just simply do not lay out, in particular the compensation provision, with any kind of particularity as to what an individual can expect.
Let me just ask you, going back to whether the state could require all people who wanted to register to vote to come down to the registrar's office. Doesn't the Voting Rights Act require the state to accept applications by mail?
The National Voter Registration Act, not the Voting Rights Act, but the National Voter Registration Act does require that states use a federally promulgated form. They must, in addition to that, make that federally promulgated form available for use by organized registration drives. I mean, that's right out of the statute. And that form has to be available for mail and delivery to the office. But that gets to this notion of personal delivery. I mean, again, there's no evidence, there's no argument of how the personal delivery requirement, as it's set up now, is narrowly tailored to deal with the interest that the state claims. And, you know, there's the NVRA issue, and I appreciate Judge Davis's question in that regard, but we also think it's a First Amendment issue. And, Mr. Mitchell presented to the court the question of the problem with my clients, as he argued it, was that we haven't identified what the speech activity or issue is. And what my clients seek to do, we make this clear in the record and in our testimony, is register more voters. Okay, what they're not interested in, what their donors do not provide money to do, is simply go out and encourage others to do it. And in fact, the record evidence is simply going out and asking others to fill out forms and providing those forms do not result in a significant number of registrations. What results in a significant number of registrations is going out, encouraging registration, providing the form, assisting with filling out the form, delivering the form.
So you're saying you have not had successful registration drives in the last 20 years?
Well, that's a...
What about the regulations that have been in effect for 20 years?
The record evidence in this case is that those regulations that were in effect 20 years ago have only been construed as the state has construed them in the last 2 years. And in fact, that's what the letters exchanged between my client and the Secretary of State established, is that this in-county residence requirement was not something that had ever been enforced. And now the Secretary of State takes the position that if you receive an application at a voter registration drive in downtown Houston and it happens to be a resident of Montgomery County, we're going to consider that a crime. That was the changed circumstance. And one of the things I think the Governor White amicus brief points out is this policy creep of the state of Texas.
I'm sorry, but I can't accept that amicus brief. Those people were in office 25 years ago, and that's legislative intent. That's not the law.
Well, nevertheless, the record evidence in this case, setting aside the amicus brief, is that there has been consistent policy creep in the last 2 to 3 years where statutes that had never been construed that way before are now being construed that way. And I'll give you an example. The entire VDR provision that's being dealt with here starts with an appointment provision. And the appointment provision says that a person who is a deputy registrar may distribute and receive applications. And the state's position is that's an exclusive grant of authority. That's not authority. It's sort of, as Judge Jones points out, the people don't have that authority on their own. This is the state's position. I disagree with it. And so the state's going to confer it. And we're conferring it in the statute and saying they can distribute and receive applications. That's the only sentence on the subject in the code. But now the state comes into court and says, well, but everybody's got a right to distribute. So our exclusive grant of authority there,
well,
just ignore that word.
You agree with the idea that no felons shouldn't be registrars, do you?
No, I don't. And I think
you don't disagree with the idea that people who are not citizens should not be registrars.
I don't disagree.
All right.
Just as I don't disagree with the state.
But then the other part of this is simply, it's a prudential requirement to have local people register local voters on the theory that the local people best know who the likely voters are.
Well, that's just, I mean, this...
Because if somebody comes to you wanting to, your people are advocating to register to vote, and somebody comes to you and says, well, here I've got a 77782-09 zip code on my address, you say, wait a minute, I'm from Harris County, that's San Antonio. Then you don't know whether that person is registered to vote in San Antonio already. It is a very prudential thing to me.
And all I can say in response to that, I understand Your Honor's position, and all I can say in response is that the overwhelming circuit opinions are in opposite to that, and so is the Buckley decision, which struck down Colorado's requirement that you have to be a registered voter to circulate petitions on the basis that there simply isn't any evidence that another American would be any more likely to commit fraud. But there's even newer authority. I mean,
let me ask you this. Well, go ahead. Excuse me.
The new Western Tradition case, the Montana Supreme Court case that the U.S. Supreme Court just reversed a few months ago under Citizens United. I mean, the Western Tradition Corporation was a Colorado corporation who wanted to engage in political speech in Montana and didn't want to disclose its donors. And the state, you know, prosecutes it. I believe it was a civil, though not a criminal, proceeding. It goes up the Montana Supreme Court. They affirm. The U.S. Supreme Court comes back and says, wait a minute, under Citizens United, out-of-state participants get to come in and participate in the election.
Didn't the Supreme Court also uphold the state of Washington regulation that required disclosure of donors?
Sure.
So the state, and no doubt the donors, were making the same kind of argument that you're making, that that chills their rights and so on, right? But the court upheld that.
The court, I agree with the court's presentation of the holding, and I believe that was the Doe v. Reed case. But I guess my point, and I'm trying to say this, I hope it comes out respectfully because I mean it that way. Your Honor has pointed out a number of lawful regulations that state can adopt that we don't disagree with. And the reason we can agree with those regulations is because they are narrowly tailored to a particular fraudulent harm. In this case, the regulations, there's no evidence that they are, and all we have is argument and innuendo that they are somehow narrowly tailored. And even in those cases, I mean, the position, for example, that a pastor can hand out applications to their parishioners, and as soon as the pastor accepts them back and she mails them in, she's become a criminal, that's simply not a justified infringement upon First Amendment rights.
We'll talk about 501c3 later.
Oh, well, that's true, which I think the IRS, I suppose, is giving some thought to. But, you know, my point here is that the statutes criminalize everyday behavior. Behavior of a neighbor who introduces themselves to somebody who's moved into the community down the street and says, welcome to Texas, welcome to Dallas. I'd love to get you registered to vote, and I'm taking my car down, and can I take yours? And they do it. I mean, these are the sort of things that happen every
but
day.
That's not prevented by this.
It certainly is. That is unlawful.
No, not unless they accept the registration and they try to file it. My understanding is they could drive their neighbor right down to the driver's license and say register.
Well, that's true. And that exact argument is what the state of Colorado tried to make in Meyer and then again later in Buckley, was that, look, there's another avenue. Yeah, it's a little bit difficult, but there is another avenue for us to pursue this speech. And the point is, as the record evidence demonstrates at page 623, the donors who give money to this effort, which we know from Citizens United, now that's core speech. When you give money to an effort to want to encourage voter registration, we've got core speech. And the donors don't do it if there's just going to be some broad communication about registration. If there's no way to receive the registration application, turn it in, track it, and confirm that the government has done their duty, it's not activity that will be undertaken. And
there's a big record here. Did you put on donors who said we won't give money?
No, but we put on our executive director who has said, number one,
it's hard for me to believe this because, after all, speech is speech. And, you know, you're saying that they only give speech if it's coupled with action. But League of Women Voters has get out the vote stuff on all the time. And nobody ever said they lack for contributions. So I just wondered.
Well, this is a place where I think the district court's deference in terms of weighing the evidence has to be respected. I mean, it's the one that's at and
what fact finding are you pointing to?
Particularly the fact finding about that organizations that I represent and others like it will not come into Texas and do the organized drives that they used to do or that they do in other states, and that donors won't give money to these organizations if the organization has no meaningful quality control. It's the same reason Exxon or IBM won't enter a particular business area. If they don't have any way to judge success, it doesn't make any sense to throw money at it. And if there's no way for Project Vote to confirm even who they have managed to convince to turn in an application, confirm that that person was registered, follow up when and if the government doesn't comply with its obligation to register them.
That was the whole problem with Acorn.
I'm sorry.
There was no meaningful quality control.
Acorn was properly dealt with.
I mean, don't the other voters of Texas have a right to know that their votes aren't being diluted by illegal votes?
They do, and what happened to Acorn is a prime example that government regulation, as it existed in the 2008 election, was effective at dealing with the issues. These new regulations, though, have really little to do with fraud in our estimation. They have to do with a legitimate effort to make it more difficult to register. And in fact, it is a political position that many hold that registration itself is a relic left over from the Jim Crow years to make it more difficult for people to secure a vote. That being said, the states adopted that policy. We just believe that we have a First Amendment right to collect these applications. We also think, with respect to the NVRA, both on the photocopy provision and on the personal delivery provision that those opinions are on point. The final thing I'll say is that this court's opinion, to the extent it finalizes and reverses the injunction, in my opinion, will be an outlier among all the other circuits and district courts in the United States that have looked at these issues. I thank the court for its careful consideration of this important case, and we respectfully request the court affirm the injunction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dunn. Back to you, Mr. Mitchell. What do you say about counsel's comment about their inability to rely on this particular Secretary of State's narrowing of the statute? I think he was talking about the compensation provision, but in general. I mean, how do they know that the next Secretary of State will follow that interpretation?
Well, they can challenge the next Secretary of State's interpretation if the successor to Ms. Andrade repudiates the construction of the statute. But there's no case or controversy right now between the plaintiffs and the state over these hypothetical interpretations that they think that might be enforced against them.
But, I mean, nothing to stop the Secretary of State from changing her position next week, I suppose.
Well, that's true. I mean, the Secretary could adopt an interpretation of the statute that violates the Constitution, but federal courts should presume that state officers who are bound by oath to respect the First Amendment and respect the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution will interpret state law in a manner that will be consistent with those binding pronouncements. Judge Jones asked Mr. Dunn and also asked me whether the state could abolish the Office of Volunteer Deputy Registrar, and the answer is yes, they could. This is not speech activity when you collect another person's completed.
Especially if the state went into same-day registration, you wouldn't need them.
That's right. We don't have same-day registration.
I know.
But there's no constitutional obligation even to establish this office in the first place. So the plaintiffs really should be thanking rather than suing the state of Texas on these questions. Now, Judge Davis points out correctly that the arguments we're advancing to defend our VDR laws could also have been made in the Meyer litigation and, in fact, were advanced in the state of Colorado's brief. But the Supreme Court in Meyer did not rule on the notion that all conduct associated with petition circulation counts as speech. There is no language in the Supreme Court's opinion endorsing that proposition.
Well, we've got to assume that they thought the conduct that was pointed out by the state of Colorado was so closely related to speech that it interfered with speech so that it was invalid.
I don't think we can make that assumption based on what the Meyer opinion says. What Meyer says is that the act of petition circulation necessarily involves speech. The court says when you tell someone you can't serve as a petition circulator, you are restricting that person's ability to speak.
Well, we know they didn't accept Colorado's argument, don't we?
They did not endorse Colorado's argument. That's correct. But I don't think we can in any way infer from the Supreme Court's opinion that they rejected the argument because they decided the case on a different ground. It's similar to solicitation. When you tell someone you can't solicit, you're telling that person that you can't speak in a certain manner. Solicitation is itself speech. And that's what the Supreme Court held in Meyer with respect to petition circulation. None of that can be said about the act of collecting a completed voter registration form. It is not speech activity, and all the speech-related activity of a voter registration drive can still be undertaken by a non-VDR. The appellees still have not been able to identify any speech act or any First Amendment activity that a non-VDR is unable to undertake. And without that, the First Amendment...
Well, I think they're saying they won't contribute money if they can't get the registrations in hand.
But that's their choice. That is not a restriction that's being imposed by the state. If people choose not to engage in First Amendment activity in response to a state's regulation of conduct, the state has not abridged their freedom of speech. They have made the conscious choice not to engage in speech.
The state keeps saying there is a First Amendment component to the regulation of voter registration. And what do you mean by that?
When you're speaking, when you say, register to vote, come over here, please vote. When you contact someone on election day and speak and tell them, come out and vote today. When one opens one's mouth and words come out, that is speech. That's protected by the First Amendment.
And that's the only thing that's protected by the First Amendment.
I wouldn't say it's the only thing that's protected. The Supreme Court has held that expressive conduct is also protected but the appellees have not advanced any argument that the act of collecting a completed voter registration form qualifies as expressive conduct.
I thought you pretty much admitted that if conduct that is so closely related to speech interferes with core speech, then that's prohibited under the First Amendment.
Well, no, I haven't made that admission. If a state's regulation of conduct necessarily involves a restriction on speech, that would implicate the First Amendment. That's essentially a ban on solicitation. Or, according to Meyer, a ban on serving as a petition circulator also qualifies as that. If you tell someone you can't solicit, you're telling them you can't speak in a certain manner. And that's not the situation we have here. See, my time's expired. Thank you, judges.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Thank you, counsel. We have your case.